Metcast, Thursday, August 7th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. I want to say thank you to all of you. I realize the last couple weeks, the shows have been few and far between. I guess I shouldn't say few and far between, but not happening as often as I would like, and I certainly think probably not as often as you would like. And I have had no comments or complaints about that. And many of you, I think, know what's going on. I've just had a crazy summer. We are in the process of doing a move. And as you know, you get busy, time gets away from you. I'm dealing a lot with contractors and different people coming in to kind of get the new house prepped. And that's been throwing the schedule off a little bit. But I'm hoping to get back on track here this month, so we'll try and get things out a little more regular than we have been. But again, thank you to all of you for just being so understanding as we kind of move through this. But we got a great show for you today, and I want to get right into that here in a second. We're going to be talking about all the very latest on the iPhone 6. There's a lot of things to update you on there. Also, some new MacBooks hit the streets, and new channels for Apple TV, as well as a little update on what's happening potentially with the iWatch. And then some great feedback and comments from you. We're going to talk a little bit about using target display mode. Maybe you know what that is. Maybe you don't, but you'll find out in this episode. Also, we got Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer in to help with a couple of more technical RAID NAS kind of questions. And then a little trick in iOS with folder names. All that and a whole lot more in this episode, so stay tuned. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, if you're thinking about getting a new iPhone or an iPad and you want to get some cash so that you can make that new purchase, Gazelle is a really great option. And my guess also is with a new iPhone right around the corner, this is something you're probably thinking about. Gazelle wants to buy your old iPhone, your iPad, your other smartphones, and give you cash for that stuff. And what I love about Gazelle, and I've used it several times when I've upgraded my devices, is that they make it so easy and simple to sell that device. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, find your item, answer a few questions about its condition, and they'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads, so don't worry if you have an old broken one. They'll give you some cash for that as well. And then right there, they give you a risk-free offer for your gadgets, and they even offer free shipping. So what could be easier? In some cases, they'll even send you a box, which is really, really cool. And you look at the offer. If you choose to accept it, you send your device in, and they're going to handle things like wiping your data for free. And you can trust them because they've been doing this for a long time. They've paid nearly $175 million to over 1 million customers. And you send it in, they receive it, they look it over. As long as everything checks out, you get paid fast. The payment's fast within a few days of your item being received, and you can get paid by check, PayPal, or even get an extra 5% on your offer if you choose to get paid with an Amazon gift card. That's actually the way I prefer to do it because I buy stuff on Amazon all the time. So the cash goes right into your Amazon account and you get a little extra. So go to gazelle.com right now to get your offer on your old iPhone, iPad, and you get to lock in that price also for 30 days. So you can have that price set, and you want to do it because the prices fluctuate. So go in there, do it now, get the best value, because every day you wait, you're losing a little bit of, potentially losing a little bit of cash on that offer. Love the service. Like I said, I've used it myself, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the Maccast. Right up front here on today's show, let's update you on the very latest rumors and things that are going on with the iPhone 6. We've been, again, seeing more parts, more supposedly legitimate parts as we get closer to Apple moving into that production phase on the iPhone, if they're going to reach that fall release date, they have to start sending components and parts to assemblers and things like that. So we've been seeing a few more things. We allegedly saw this past week, an iPhone 6 logic board from the French site nowhereelse.fr. And on that main board, it didn't actually show any chips attached in the image, but the poster, the source claimed that it is going to have NFC chips as well as 802.11.ac Wi-Fi, which is the latest Wi-Fi that's currently shipping in Macs. And that 802.11.ac rumor was actually echoed by a piece in VentureBeat. So a lot of people are putting some faith in the 802.11ac making its way into the iPhone finally. I'm a little bit tentative and hesitant about that rumor, specifically because I think power would be a potential issue, although there may be something that's handling that as well. A little bit later, we're going to hear about the battery and some new battery rumors with the iPhone 6, but I still wonder about that. And I also really feel that Apple's not doing NFC, but that rumor keeps cropping up over and over again. Another potential stumbling block that we've been talking about with the iPhone 6 is that sapphire glass display. It's been back and forth. Is it going to have sapphire? Is it not going to have sapphire? VentureBeat came out and claimed that Apple is holding off on the sapphire this time around because of some of the production issues. There was also a report that came in, I think, last week from a site called LED Inside that claimed that the sapphire ingot production was down this year. And that means that Apple has nowhere near enough sapphire to supply the number of iPhone 6s that they would need to. And they're saying that means no sapphire glass in the iPhone. And seemingly backing up that report was some other rumors that so far sapphire displays have not been shipping over to assembly partners in China. So Apple's partners aren't getting displays shipped over right now. Therefore, that means they're not going to have them to actually put into iPhones. So then you might be saying to yourself, well, didn't we just talk about a couple weeks ago the guy who supposedly had one of these sapphire glass displays and put it through all kinds of torture tests, stabbing with a knife, bending it, flexing it? Well, it turns out that later on, some sites said that might not be sapphire glass, or at least not 100% sapphire glass. And now with these latest rumors, we're hearing reports that, nope, it was really just a newer form of the Gorilla Glass. So at this point, I'm not sure what sources to believe. I think Apple's going with new materials. I think they've been kind of hinting at this through some of the things they've been saying publicly. And I really think we're going to see sapphire displays across the board in all Apple's future products. And I think the key hinging point is their partnership with GT Advanced Technologies. So, you know, there is some hope because Apple Insider even pointed out with these latest rumors, it was unclear in the reports whether anybody was thinking about that Arizona sapphire plant and if they were just kind of looking at existing sapphire suppliers. So Apple's got tight integration with GT Advanced Technologies. There could be some secret stuff going on there that really hasn't been leaked out publicly. And as a matter of fact, the Mac Observer had a report of a research analyst, Matt Margolis from PTT, who says he might know exactly why we're getting all these conflicting reports. He did a little investigating and looking into what was going on with GT Advanced Technologies. And if you remember, we had heard reports back in January that they had 120 furnaces online producing sapphire glass. Now, supposedly, according to Matt Margolis, they have 2,600 furnaces producing sapphire out of that facility. And the analyst discovered also that GT Advanced Technology has been banking revenue. They have $154 million in deferred revenue that's been building up over the last couple quarters. And the speculation is that that's money tied up in 2 years of sapphire production, a sapphire hoard that they're going to be offloading to Apple for production of the iPhone 6. And I think that's a viable thing. So I think there's a lot of people in the industry and a lot of people looking at the wrong side of the supply chain, and they're not really seeing what's going on over here in the States in this sapphire plant. And I think it's kind of slipped by a lot of people. So I think we're still in line to get sapphire, but you never know. Until Apple actually announces the darn thing, we're not really going to find out. And there just seems to be a lot of confusion and a lot of speculation, as there always is with Apple products. Another thing that's kind of happening this week is we're hearing a little bit more about some of the specific specifications with the processor, specifically in the 4.7-inch and the 5.5-inch designs. And if you've been listening to the show, I think my worst nightmare could be coming true if this next rumor pans out. And that's because Cowen and Company analyst Timothy Akuri claims that his supply chain checks are showing that there could be different processors in each one of those phones. So the 4.7, the 5.5 would have different versions of the A6. And of course, the bigger phone, the 5.5 inch, is going to get the bigger, badder A8 processor. Did I say A6? I meant A8 processor. And unfortunately, he gives no specific details on exactly what the differences would be, although he does kind of say that the A8 and the larger phone is going to be based on a bigger die. And so that could mean things like a different graphics processor or maybe a new process for the actual fabrication of the chip. So something significantly different. As far as the actual A8 spec rumors we've been hearing that Apple is going to bump up the processor clock speed significantly up to 2 gigahertz, but still remain at dual core, but that they would also be doubling the amount of RAM up to 2 gigabytes of RAM from 1 gigabyte of RAM. And if you know the current processor, the A7, it's running at about 1.3 gigahertz. So a significant processor bump, but not jumping all the way to quad core like some of the other smartphones that Apple's competitors are putting out. But again, Apple, because of their tight hardware and software integration, they can do a lot more in terms of performance and tweaking. And then we also know just the graphics and things like metal and the technologies in the operating system, that's going to even push even more speed and performance out of Apple's package, something that their competitors have a really hard time matching. So, you know, as far as processor goes, I think, you know, 2 gigahertz, A8. I don't know about this sort of differing spec. I really hope it doesn't come to fruition, because I really think the 4.7-inch form factor is the one that I'm going to want to buy. But if the 5.5 is significantly better in terms of specs, you know, who's going to want the 4.7-inch? It's sort of like last year's model. I guess it'll still be pumped up, but it's going to feel like, you know, you're getting some sort of middle-tier model, you're not getting the latest and greatest. And I think us early adopters, that's what we really want, the best device that we can get at the time, or that's how kind of I feel about it. But just a 5.5-inch screen seems really way too big to me. So I guess the best case scenario for me, and I don't know how you feel about it, would be that Apple puts out one size 4.7, and you know, it has everything in it that we've been waiting for. And I guess one of those things that a lot of us are also waiting for is improved battery life, a little bit bigger battery. Last month, we saw images and heard reports that there was going to be a 1,801 milliamp hour battery. That's only slightly bigger than the 1,560 milliamp hour battery that's currently in the iPhone 5S. So because of improved specs, the bigger screen, it was kind of speculated that the larger battery would bring about the same battery life performance as the current iPhone 5S. Well, this week, a Chinese site, G4Games, claims that the 4.7-inch iPhone 6 could actually have a 2100 milliamp hour battery, which would be good news and would be the news that we want to hear, because that means we might be actually getting more battery life out of the next generation model, the larger phone. And that's what you would hope. With a larger phone, you can have a larger battery, which means maybe a little bit better battery life. Although I will point out that the source is a little bit sketchy at best. G4Games doesn't have, you know, a solid or a long-running track record with Apple rumors, but It is a rumor that I'd like to see actually come true. So hopefully they're on the money on this one. And then also, last kind of thing is a design leak. We saw some new design images, this time from Feld and Volk. They're an iPhone repair site. They claim to actually have a completed iPhone 6 rear shell. And looking at it, a couple little minor changes from some of the stuff that we've seen before. Slightly recessed volume buttons on the cutouts on the side, so still the elongated pill-shaped volume buttons, but a little bit more indented from what we've seen previously, which would mean a little kind of slimmer profile on there. They also claim to have the little Apple logo piece that's going to go in the cutout. Now, that cutout, it has been speculated that Apple might have had a light-up Apple logo, maybe even something with multicolored LEDs so you could customize sort of visual alerts using the Apple logo, something that I thought would be really cool. There was also some speculation that it might be plastic to allow for radio transparency for something like NFC. Well, in this latest leak, they actually show a metal Apple logo, so a metal piece more like the current iPhone 5S design. And they noted that it was very scratch resistant. So the speculation is that it could be liquid metal alloy. And we've known that Apple's had that partnership for liquid metal for a long time, but that part of the issue is producing larger and larger pieces. So this would be a little bit bigger piece than the last piece of liquid metal Apple supposedly shipped, which was the little SIM ejector tool. So maybe they're trying to ramp up and kind of see if they can take that material to the next level. And this would be a good way to do it. In this phone, but that's pure speculation on the point on the part of Feld and Volk. They have nothing to really back it up other than the logo seems very scratch resistant. And I would argue that the logo, the Apple logo in the current iPhone 5S is scratch resistant. I've, not seen any scratches on mine, so who knows? And then the last kind of design change that we saw, and one that I'm hoping doesn't turn out to be reality, is a protruding camera lens. So we know that Apple's been trying to maximize the thinness, I think is the right way to say that, of the iPhone 6. And one way they could do that is, not worry about the camera lens, something that they've done on the iPod Touch, right? It has the little camera bump. I'm not a big fan of the camera bump. I like the flush look. I'd rather it maybe be just, a couple tenths of a millimeter thicker to accommodate the camera system, but Apple reportedly is improving the camera sensors and stuff like that, so maybe it takes up a little more space and we've got to have a little slight protrusion. Again, something I'm hoping is not really the case, but still could be. And the other thing that we keep seeing flopping back and forth that I really hope doesn't come to fruition is the antenna gaps and the little metal ends. If you sort of watch the rumor sites and things like that, you may know about renderings from Martin Hajek. He is this amazing, amazing 3D artist who does renderings based on a lot of the rumors and speculation. He has some beautiful new iPhone 6 renderings out. And with his, you've got the nice thin just line on the top and bottom for the antenna, and then he has, instead of the metal insert, the glass inserts like we see on the current iPhone 5S. And I think that looks beautiful. These other renderings where we've got this sort of surrounding antenna break that goes all the way around the top and the bottom, and then we get this metal piece inserted in like that. I just can't believe that Jony Ive would let something out like that out the door. I just think it looks so ugly. But again, I'm willing to kind of back up and say, in practice, when, or an actual execution in the production product, maybe it looks better than sort of the renderings and, just speculative sketches that we've been seeing so far are. But I have a hard time believing it this time around because it's so jarring and it's just breaks up the lines of the device in just a way that I really, really hate. So I don't know how you feel about that stuff, but I guess that's my opinion. And, only time will tell. We need to get an actual look at this thing as far as when we will actually see the iPhone 6. Several reliable sources this week claimed that September 9th is going to be the day of the announcement that we'll get the keynote announcing the iPhone 6. And immediately, I think it was Recode that broke the news, but almost right after it and very quickly, that date was confirmed by both the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg. So I think that's very likely to be the date. About all we need now is one more yep from the bearded one from Jim Dalrymple over at The Loop. And then you can pretty much start booking your tickets if you need to get to San Francisco for the announcement. But that's the very latest on the iPhone 6. We also, about a week ago or so, got slightly refreshed MacBook Pros. Apple posted a minor update to its MacBook Pro with Retina display models last week. You basically got a 200 megahertz processor bump across the entire line. The entry-level models also now have double the RAM standard, so the 13-inch base model now comes with 8 gigabytes, and the 15-inch base model version comes with 16 gigabytes. And then there was a price drop on the top-of-the-line 15-inch model, the one with the discrete NVIDIA graphics. Its price was dropped by $100. Pricing on the other models remained the same. And so you get a little bit more processor, same pricing, unless you're going all the way to the top end, and then you're going to get $100 off. You're also going to get $100 off if you want the non-Retina 13-inch model, which did hang around. That was surprising. It actually didn't get axed. It's now at a reduced price of $10.99, and so you have all those options available. As far as what you can expect from performance on the new models, there was a Geekbench 3 result that surfaced on the entry-level 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, the updated one with the new processor, and it seemed to indicate it was about 8% faster than the entry-level model from 2013. So you can get a little bit of a performance boost, not a lot. I'd expect between 5 and 15%. Depending upon the task, something like that. But, you know, nice to see them doing a little bit of a bump. And it actually, I think, turns out something that they had to do at this point, because as we've talked about in the past, Intel has been continually delaying the release of its next generation Broadwell chips. And so Apple opted to go the minor speed bump route and drop the prices a little bit to kind of get us through the end of the year. And just freshen up the MacBook Pro line a little bit. Now, there's some other lines that you're probably thinking, well, Apple should be updating some of their other models as well. Specifically, how about the Mac Mini? That thing hasn't seen an update in forever. And there looked to be some sort of good news this past week, because somebody noticed and discovered that a mid-2014 Mac Mini model was referenced in an Apple support document for Boot Camp. The reference is gone now, and so far nothing has really come of it. We haven't heard of a Mac Mini update, but it certainly is way overdue. The Mac Observer pointed out that the last bump to the Mac Mini was October 2012. That's 640 days ago. And currently, the average number of days for Apple to take between Mac updates is around 373 days. So they're just almost at about double the amount of time for the Mac Mini. And I love the Mac Mini. It's one of my favorite models of the Mac. So it'd be nice to see Apple giving that a little bit of love and bumping up some of the specs and processor there. And then not long after the Mac Mini reference was discovered, there was also one for the iMac that was discovered by a French site. They found another non-existent updated Mac reference, this time for a mid-2014 iMac, in a chart detailing which versions of Microsoft Windows are compatible with Apple hardware. I actually think it was the same Boot Camp document, to be honest, when I was kind of looking at the tables. And again, we haven't heard any updates of the iMac, and that reference was pulled from that webpage. So you can't read too much into any of these slips, especially with tables, because it could be something as simple as someone doing a copy and paste error as they're updating the tables. But it certainly kind of falls into the time frame with new Broadwell chips not coming out. Apple needs to do some incremental bumps, something that's going to kind of help them finish out the year, get stronger sales, get some new models into the pipeline, and then we'll see what happens in 2015. But at least for now, we do have some updated MacBook Pros and hopefully some other updated Macs here before the end of the year. If you flipped on your second gen or third gen Apple TV this week, you might have noticed that Apple once again has updated some of your channels. They added Fox Now and CNBC channels. Unfortunately, as is typical, the content is limited if you don't already have access to the cable versions of those channels. This is something that I really hate, and it seems to be par for the course now on the Apple TV, as we keep getting new channels, but unless you already have it, have that channel on your cable subscription, you get kind of limited half the content. And frankly, for me, I turn off most of those channels because I don't find a lot of value in them. Some are better than others, you know, to give some of them credit. But, you know, the whole point of having an Apple TV, in my opinion, is to not have cable, to have alternative content, have iTunes content, have your Netflix and other sorts of things. We want to be, I want to be a cord cutter at some point, and 100% cord cutter. I have kind of basic cable to kind of get me by, so I have the standard channels, but I don't get access to a lot of this other content. And if I already had it on my cable TV, then why do I need it on my Apple TV? And I know the answer, and you're going to email me and tell me exactly that, you know, on demand. So I don't have to be in front of my TV at whatever time that show comes on. And I get that. Believe me, I get that. But, you know, to pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for access to that stuff, I don't know, it just doesn't fit into personally into my budget. So, but you do have a couple more channel options there. And unfortunately, I think these channel updates might be all we get for a while. You remember earlier this year, there was a lot of speculation that there was pending Apple TV hardware updates, and the rumors were going hot and heavy for a while. The big rumor being that we were going to get a major gaming update, that we'd have at least games and maybe more apps coming to the Apple TV, motion control, and it was supposedly all part of this, you know, kind of big upgrade plan that Apple was working on, and it was building up to about WWDC. I was trying to think about the time frame, and then everything just kind of petered out and went silent, and then we didn't hear anything more. And now we are actually hearing, don't expect any Apple TV hardware updates until 2015. And why? Well, guess what? Our good friends, the content providers, oh no, they would never complicate anything or gum up the works, right? Yeah, those guys are reportedly kind of holding things back. Apple's trying to do deals, but it's just not coming to fruition. And the report says that it's really ongoing contractual issues with the cable companies, and also kind of the whole Comcast pending purchase of Time Warner Cable, that's put a little bit of a kink in the timeline and pushed back any updates coming anytime soon from Apple. Now, of course, for their part, sources in the television industry, they deny that the cable companies are behind the delay. They say that Apple's plans are just too ambitious, that they have bitten off more than they can chew. They need permissions that need to come from too many different rights holders to kind of create the service that they want to offer. And that is more of what is holding things up, that, you know, Apple's too ambitious. Well, I want Apple to be ambitious. I hope they are. I hope they're shooting for the moon and putting their customers first, something that they always tend to do. And I guess that's going to take a little bit longer than Apple wants, and probably a little bit longer than we want as well. I'd love to see a new updated Apple TV. But if in the end it means I get it next year, but with all the things that Apple wants to put into it, then that's probably worth it. And, you know, we're going to see these kind of statements from both sides, and they really seem to give some credibility to those long ago rumors that Apple wants to create a subscription TV service. That's probably what's going on here, and that's probably what, you know, these arguments on both sides are kind of pointing to, that Apple's trying to do a deal with the content providers, with the cable providers, to bring us a kind of service where we're not going to have to authorize our channels via our cable subscription, that we'll actually be able to buy a subscription to the content and to the channels we want directly through Apple from the Apple TV. And I'm excited for that day to happen. So if that means I have to wait till next year for Apple to get those deals done, then I guess so be it. And then finally in the news for today, production delays for the iWatch may mean that we don't see Apple's wearable this year, at least if you believe KGI security analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, and I tend to put some stock in his rumors. He's done a pretty good job in the past. He reportedly sent out a note to his investors where he said he believes that Apple will push back production of the iWatch from September to the second half of November. That would mean Apple getting the iWatch out pretty late in the year. He says it also means that Apple would sell significantly fewer units of the iWatch in 2014. Some of the reports we've been hearing said that Apple could sell as many as 5 to 10 million units in 2014. Now Kuo feels the number could fall to just 3 million units this year. I would assume then ramping up to huge production numbers in 2015. But he also thinks that not all of the units will use sapphire glass. Another rumor we'd been hearing was that the iWatch is going to have sapphire glass. And Kuo cites some of the things that we've been hearing before in these other rumors, what we were talking about earlier with the iPhone, right? Bottlenecks in sapphire glass production. So some iWatches having sapphire glass, some not. And I guess that would lend some credence to the idea and the rumors we've been hearing that Apple might have different tiers or different levels of the iWatch, different styles. So you have, high-end premium versions and then more affordable, maybe consumer level versions of the iWatch. Again, that's one of those ones that I waffle on. I can see the point. I can see why people might be saying that Apple would do that, but it just doesn't seem like Apple's style, right? To come out with a bunch of different models right out of the gate. Usually you're going to get that one choice, the premium choice, and then as the product matures, Apple sort of expands the line. That's what we saw with the iWatch. That's what we saw with the iPhone and iPads, and I think that's going to kind of be how Apple progresses. So I expect sort of one iWatch. It's going to be, a little bit on the premium side, premium priced, and early adopters are gonna flock to it. How many million units is probably gonna they do this year is probably gonna depend on when they get it out, and hopefully they have it in the announcement in September and ready to go on sale or get it shipped out at least before the end of the year. November seems to me like it might be a little bit late to kind of get a product out, but yeah, I guess it could happen. But so with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Kicking off the feedback from you section this week, Scott sent me an email and he is looking to upgrade his iMac and wanted to know if he could use Target Display Mode with his new model iMac and use it as a display for his work PC, which he has to bring home and use from time to time at his house. So he's going to have a Mac at home, got a PC at work, gonna bring the PC home, laptop, wants a bigger screen. Why not use the iMac screen, the big, gorgeous 27-inch iMac screen? And you certainly can do that with Target Display Mode, or you could. For those of you who aren't familiar, Target Display Mode was a feature that Apple added to the iMac in 2009, and it came out of this thing like so many people had iMacs, and they said, "Why can't I use this as a display? Maybe they upgrade, right? And now I want to use my old iMac as just a nice 27-inch display." And so Apple addressed this. They added this Target Display Mode feature. And what it allowed you to do was basically take a cable, plug it into the mini display port on your iMac, and then put it into Target Display Mode and use it as a display. And using various adapters, you could connect it to something that, supported mini display port or display port, also DVI and even HDMI sources. So you could plug in, an HDMI out into an HDMI to display port adapter, plug that into your iMac, put the iMac into Target Display Mode, and use that as a monitor. Really, really cool feature. You can actually also use the feature with any Mac that has a built-in display. So you could use a MacBook Pro, for example. So you could use that as a display for a second display for an iMac if you put that MacBook Pro in Target Disk Mode. So actually how you enable Target Display Mode, rather, sorry. I'm probably gonna keep mixing that up just so you know. target display mode. If you want to enable it, the way you do it is you connect the two Macs together via their mini display ports or their Thunderbolt ports. And then you just make sure both computers are turned on and not asleep. They both need to be on and awake. And then press the Command F2 key on the keyboard of the external display computer. So the computer you want to act as the display, you're going to press Command F2, and that will put it into target display mode. If you want the external display to also play audio as well as get the video from the main Mac, then you just need to go into the Apple menu, into the System Preferences, and click on Sound, and then adjust the output. And you can select the external display from the list of devices there and set it as the output for your audio. To turn off target display mode, you basically do the same thing in reverse. You press Command F2 on the external display, the Mac you're using as the display, and that will take it out of target disk mode. So it's kind of like a toggle, Command F2 for target display mode. Did I say target disk mode again? I think I did. Sorry about that. The two are so similar, right? Anyway, so this is all well and good, and really cool, but let's get back to Scott's needs. So he needs to know, if I buy this new iMac, I have my PC, will it work with my PC? Because the Mac has Thunderbolt. And unfortunately, Scott, the answer is no, but it's really not because it's a PC. The issue is actually Thunderbolt. And even though Thunderbolt is really mini DisplayPort compatible, it uses the mini DisplayPort style connector, it under the hood is actually different. And the difference is because the connection doesn't carry just the display signal anymore, it also carries I.O., the Thunderbolt I.O., and it has the Thunderbolt controllers, it acts differently. So what that means is that a Thunderbolt Mac can be used in target display mode, but only for sources that are also sending out Thunderbolt. So you need to connect a Thunderbolt Mac to a Thunderbolt Mac in target display mode to actually get it to work. Older Macs that are not Thunderbolt, the mini display port Mac, so if you had an older iMac that was mini display port, you could use a source like your PC or your gaming console in target display mode, and that would actually work. And you could use different adapters. So if your PC was outputting DVI, for example, you could do DVI to mini display port into that older iMac, and you would have it show up and run in target display mode, no problem whatsoever. Unfortunately, it sounds like you're not going to have, because it's a PC, you're not going to have it as a Thunderbolt device. I don't know if you had a PC and you went out and bought a Thunderbolt PCI card or something like that, put it in. That probably would work. As long as you got Thunderbolt coming out and going into a Thunderbolt device that's acting as your target display, it will work. But barring that going on, it's not going to work for you. So if you really want to use your Mac's display as a monitor for your PC, there's only one other option that I can think of, and I'm not sure that it's the best option, but it may work in a pinch. There's a great piece of software called Screen Recycler, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It basically uses VNC, Virtual Network Client, to mirror your display over the network, so from your PC to your Mac's display, and it takes over the whole screen, so it looks like it's a display. You don't even have to connect it with wires because it's going over the network, so if you're using Wi-Fi. But the problem there is the performance isn't always that great, so depending upon what kind of tasks you need to do with that work PC, definitely not video editing or any high-level gaming, things like that, but if you're just doing email and office documents, Screen Recycler works really, really great, and they even have something called Jolly VNC, which is a little bit faster, better performing VNC client that you can get bundled with it. That'll help with the performance issues a little bit. But, you know, for you, I would say probably what you want to do, LCD monitors have come way down in price. You can get like a 24-inch LCD monitor for probably between 150 to maybe 200, 250 bucks, something like that. So you could get that to use for your work PC. And then the side benefit is you could connect that to your iMac to use that as a second display. So hook that up to the Thunderbolt port. If you need an adapter, again, to go to DVI, you just get one of those. Plug that in, and now you have a second monitor to use with your iMac. And then when you bring that the work PC home, you can just use that monitor as the monitor for the PC. So I think that's what I would do if I were you. If not, look into Screen Recycler, and that may get you by. But thanks, Scott, for the email. This week, I had a couple listener questions that I really felt were outside my own experiences, or knew were outside my own experiences, because the questions that came in, one was regarding using iTunes with a network-attached storage device, which I don't own any traditional network-attached storage devices, and the other question was about RAID systems or RAID drives, and I'm a Drobo guy, so Drobo is, I guess, technically RAID, but it's really a little bit different. And this question was more about something, or actually specifically about a Synology RAID. And so because I don't have experience with those two things, I decided, I need to call in for some backup. And one of the best bits of backup, or best people I have for backup with regard to NAS and RAIDs and things like that, is Dave Hamilton, host of the Mac Geek Gab podcast over at the Mac Observer. And I happen to know he has worked with NAS drives. He has a Synology RAID. So I asked him for help on these next couple questions.
Dave Hamilton, hey, thanks for coming on the MacCast to help me out with this one. You're my, I think, resident RAID NAS guru.
I turned to
Mac Geek Gab. You know a lot more about this stuff than I do.
Yeah, I wouldn't call me a guru, but maybe you would, and I'll take that title.
How about compared to me, you're more sagely.
I certainly have spent far more time than I should have with this stuff, and so hopefully I've learned some things that can help keep you and your listeners from having to spend far too much of your time.
Yeah, see, I cheat, especially when it comes to when it comes to NAS and RAID, because I only use Drobos. And direct connected Drobos, so
yep.
And then to get NAS functionality, I have a Mac Mini with a Drobo, and the Mac Mini is really handling the network side of things. So
yeah, I'm a big fan of true NAS drives. The 5N, the Drobo 5N, sort of dips its toe into that water and is getting further and further down that path in a good way. Synology, QNAP, those kinds of things. I'm a big fan of those, but there is something to be said about doing the Mac Mini method, because it is an OS. It's far more powerful than any NAS you'll buy, and it's not cheap, but none of these things are cheap.
So. Well, yeah, but the thing is it's my Mini. It's an Intel Core Duo, not a 2 Duo. The old Core Duo model, and it's served me incredibly. But I want to get to these couple questions that I received from some of my listeners. Let's take the NAS question first. It's Mark, and I actually now realize sort of what probably happened here. But Mark bought a new iMac, so he's had a Drobo FS that he's been using with his iTunes library on it with a Mac for years, and it's been going great and working fine. Well, he recently upgraded to a new iMac and rebuilt it from scratch, went to hook up the Drobo, and now it's not seeing his music library.
Aha.
And movies library. So you probably just realized what I just realized happened here. I think what happened here is the library file is probably still pointing somehow to the old setup, is going to be my guess. And so what he wanted to know is, how can I get everything rebuilt without actually having to go back to, bring everything back into iTunes and then remigrate it?
Yeah, so I mean, if all of your iTunes data is stored somewhere else on the network, and in Mark's case, it happens to be on a Drobo FS, but he's just using, in this particular use case, he's using the Drobo FS as nothing more than a file sharing destination. Right?
Exactly. So yeah.
He needs to make sure he's mounted to it, right?
Right.
And there are, and that gets dicey. I will point out. You want to auto mount. I would recommend auto mounting it. What I do with my NAS and network volumes is I auto mount them by by first manually mounting it by clicking on it in the sidebar of the Finder and connecting to it and then getting the share up. And then I drag whatever the share is into my account login items window.
Exactly. Yeah, in the system preferences. Yep.
And that mounts it great. The issue there is that it won't stay mounted after sleep. Ooh, so, yeah. So there's a couple ways you can go. You can try Drobo. You know, there's a Drobo app running on your Mac all the time. You can go into that Drobo app and check a box in there that will tell it to mount the shares from the app. Sometimes that works and actually keeps it mounted or remounts it after sleep. But I never had a whole lot of luck with that. So I wound up using a piece of software called Control Plane, which is also a really bizarre piece of software to use. The user interface is not entirely intuitive. When you think you've got it working, it's not. But the gist of that is you set up criteria that define when you are in a certain profile. And so I have a set of criteria that is listed as wake up. And I've used the wake up test to define that my machine has just woken up. And then I've attached mount these three network shares to the wake up thing. And so when it when my machine wakes up, it says, okay, yeah, I've woken up. And then it goes and mounts those drives. And that works flawlessly once I got it working, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just a little weird because you would think that all you have to do is say, if the machine wakes up, do this. But there's this middle step of setting the criteria map to an overall event. And the reason for that is Control Plane is sort of a Swiss Army knife thing. And I know we're on a bit of a tangent here, but
right. No, it's important.
Help. Yeah. It's a bit of a Swiss Army knife. And so for the most part, people are using it, or its design was, let's say you have a portable Mac and you use it at home and at your office, and you want your Mac to be able to decide definitively that it is either at home or at the office, and then make some changes, perhaps some firewall changes or
network settings, printer settings.
You want to mount certain drives in one location or the other, and so no one piece of criteria is necessarily going to be enough to say I am home or I am in the office. And that's where this Control Plane, this three-stage thing is created. You say, okay, well, if you see that the network name is office on the Wi-Fi, then that's 80% chance we're at the office. And but, you know, you might not have Wi-Fi on because you might have plugged in via Ethernet. So we've got to have other criteria. And so that's why there's this three thing.
Yep.
When you're doing it with wake up from sleep, it sort of becomes an extra step, but that's all. So first, you want it mounted, and we've just talked about that.
Right.
And then, secondly, to your point, Adam, inside iTunes, I think it's advanced.
Right.
Where it is.
It's iTunes.
Is that right?
Yes. iTunes preferences, the advanced tab. You need to make sure your media folder location is set, right?
To whatever that share is. That's right.
Yep. And then the two check boxes. Keep media organized, media folder organized, and copy media folder when adding to library are usually checked, I think.
Yeah. And the other thing you can do to keep, I'm assuming that's what you did on your old Mac, because that's the part that makes sense. You actually keep the iTunes library file in your home directory,
correct,
which is its default location. And then you're just pointing the media directory there. But it's also possible to do like symlinks or other types of aliases,
right,
and have all of that stored on your NAS. That gets a little more convoluted. Yeah. If you did it the first way, in theory, what you'd want to do is copy those files, the iTunes library files from Home Music iTunes. I think that's where it lives, right?
Yeah, yes.
Home Music iTunes. In fact, copy everything from that folder from your old Mac to your new Mac. And then that way you keep all your playlists and all that other stuff.
Right.
And that might even automatically keep your pointer to your NAS drive. But if it doesn't, you just use the step that you just mentioned, and that'll get you there, I think.
Right? Well, yeah. And then the only other thing that I've had to do sometimes is after you do that, you might need to go into the iTunes or into the file library, right? And there's the, I think it's the Consolidate Media, something like that. Which will, yeah. If those links have broken for some reason, if somehow the path changed right. or the volume name changed, or I mean, it shouldn't have in this case, but sometimes you may need to get it to like sort of refine everything. And that's what I'm wondering if is happening in this case is, you know, because he didn't move the files on the Drobo, but he did set up a new Mac. So assuming you move, you know, you restored from your backup and now your library files were the ones that were on your old machine, they may just need to be re-sort of linked up.
Yeah. And that can happen. Once you get everything pointed in terms of the preferences the right way, oftentimes the best way to get them re-linked up is to go play just tell one of the files to play and it will say, I can't find this file, go find it for me, and give you a file dialog. And then you have to navigate all the way in, you know, through the artist folder, through the album folder, to the very song that you want to play. But when you do that, I think there's even a checkbox that you can tell iTunes to kind of intuit from this answer where everything else might be. And
I've never had much luck with it, personally. No.
I've only had to do it a couple times because I tend to keep all my music. I decided a long time ago to keep all my music on a volume or share, it doesn't matter, called Music.
Right.
And that way, it doesn't matter what I do to my Mac, as long as I have a volume or share called Music, that's where my music is, and I'll never have to deal with this problem again. But if you do have to deal with it, I found that it took like three or four different times. Like the first time we'd get maybe 60% of my library, but there would be some bits and pieces that it just couldn't inherit the settings from, even though they were all the same.
Right.
Nothing had changed. But it took, I don't know, maybe half a dozen, maybe even a dozen kind of re-pointers, and then everything was fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird. iTunes needs to be nuked and paved.
We'll see what happens in 12. But yeah, you know, I just always have found if you just do the whole... and again, this is only if you're having, you know, if you're letting it sort of organize your media library, which I let it do because it just seems to function better that way. You just go file, library, and then it's organized library. And there's a checkbox that says consolidate all files. And, you know, it's not going to move anything or it's stuff that's already there and it knows where it is. It's just that if there's anything sort of out of place, it'll just bring it all back together and refix any of those pointers. So I think that I think that'll take care of it in this case. And it shouldn't be much more complicated than that.
Yeah, it should work out. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So hopefully that helps you out, Mark. And let us know if it doesn't. We'll dig in a little bit further. And then the second one, this is the one where I just got lost because Ivor was asking me about, he just bought a Synology DS14 415 Play model. It's on his way to him. He plans to put in eventually four terabyte red drives, which that's great. I don't know how you feel. I guess this is a side question. How do you feel about drives these days in terms of externals? The reds, for people who don't know, tend to be NAS optimized or network attached storage optimized drives. Are they really necessary anymore?
Totally.
Yeah.
They are. They're more so now. Yeah. I used to buy green drives because when the very first Drobos came out, that's actually what they recommended you use.
Right.
So I was like, okay, great. And you know, they're low power and low speed, but you know, low speed when you've got four of them reading and writing simultaneously and independently of each other, you still get plenty of speed. Even with green drives, four green drives in my NAS, I could soak up my gigabit Ethernet pipe. So that was never an issue.
Right.
But the issue is that those green drives, when they're built, they are not built for NAS units. And NAS units are not built for them. And that's the hard part.
That's the key.
When they have an error, they... You know, the drive notices it has an error and it tries to fix it itself, which is how all drives work nowadays. And that's a good thing, but it takes time to fix that error. So the drive goes offline, fixes its error, comes back online, says back to the interface, all is good. I'm here again. If red drives do that much faster than green drives, and most NAS units are not as tolerant of those timeouts as say desktop computers are. So you wind up getting errors with the green drives. And in Drobos, if you get more, I think it's more than like three of those, the drive is blacklisted by serial number in that particular Drobo. So it can never be used in it again. even if the drive is totally fine.
Right.
So because of that, I've regrettably.
I've moved to Reds. They're not that much more expensive.
No, I mean, they're not. No,
marginally, not. Really. Yeah. So yeah. get the
not
Red Drives.
Regrettably, reluctantly, been buying Red Drives. So there you go.
Yeah. So the point is here, he can only afford two of them to kind of get started. So eventually he wants to have four terabytes in this Synology. He's only going to do two up front. And so the question becomes, he's looking at, you know, he wants the redundancy and he wants the maximum storage for the maximum amount of protection he can get. So it's sort of like, how do I optimize this? So he's been looking at, you know, do I do RAID 1 or SHR 2? RAID 5, I guess 5 plus 1 might be an option. No, definitely don't want just RAID 5, I don't think, because that doesn't give you redundancy if I'm remembering my RAIDs correct.
No, RAID 5 gives you redundancy.
That's the redundancy. Five, one is yeah, the RAID, mirroring, right?
One is mirroring, yep, which gives you redundancy,
right.
But always uses half of your storage. RAID 5, let's go through them quickly.
Right.
RAID 0 is no redundancy. That's where
that's scary RAID is what.
Yeah, you create one volume that spans all of your disks, and that's that. Doesn't matter. It's striping with nothing else.
Right.
But it's super fast.
So if you have 2 4 terabyte drives, you're going to have a fast 8 gigabytes, right?
8 terabytes. Yeah.
Or terabytes, excuse me. Keep saying gigabytes when I mean terabytes.
Right. And if you have 3 of them with RAID 0, you would have 12 terabytes. That's just right. How that works. Okay. So RAID 1 is mirroring. So it basically, I think it only works with 2 drives, right? But maybe you could, I've never tried it, but I suppose you could RAID 1 with 4 drives, 2 of them being clones of the other 2.
Yeah. Now, Ivor said when he did his calculator on RAID 1, it was telling him, and this is where I thought it was odd, it said to give 4 terabytes available with 12 terabytes of protection with all or 12 terabytes of protection with all 4 drives in place.
Okay, that's the answer. Is it just lets it 1 drive's worth of storage
and everything else is redundant.
Is redundant. Yeah, so you're just adding levels of redundancy. Okay.
Right, yeah. So he says obviously that's not ideal. Yeah. Like we don't want RAID 1 cuz I'm going to put 4 drives in and only have four terabytes and only have 4 terabytes of storage. So that's not optimizing your storage versus redundancy. So that brings us back to RAID SHR 5. Which I guess is a Synology thing.
So let's talk about RAID 5 because that's probably where most of us think we want to go, and then we'll talk about why we want to go to Synology's thing. Okay. So RAID 5, you have to have a minimum of 3 drives, and the way it works is it combines striping with fault tolerance or parity. So in the case where you have 2 drives, RAID 5 basically would mirror, although RAID 5 wouldn't work, it would just be mirroring.
Right.
With 3 drives, you get essentially 2 drives worth of data. So if you have 3 4 terabyte drives, you'd get 8 terabytes of usable data. And then one of the drives, it's not how it works, but the size worth of one of the drives is saved for parity, which means if any one of the drives dies, the other 2 drives have the data available to rebuild what was out there on the drive that got destroyed. So that's where you want to start. RAID 5 plus 1 is with a built-in hot spare, meaning if a drive dies, it automatically rebuilds it on the hot spare.
Got you.
You know, I would if I have a 4-bay unit, I wouldn't do 3 plus 1. I would do 4.
Right.
You know, but there's reasons you might choose that. So, but the trick with the issue with RAID is that every drive must be the same size. And if you want to move to larger size drives with RAID, with any of these RAIDs, including RAID 5, you basically have to start from scratch. There are some times where you could, let's say, replace a 4 terabyte drive with a 6 terabyte drive, but you'd only be using 4 terabytes of it until you got to the point where all your drives are now 6 terabytes, and then you can expand up and use that space. But in order to use the extra space on any drive, all of your drives must have the same amount of storage on them. And so you know, Drobo was to me the first company that had a product that did this, but Drobo's Beyond RAID concept means you can use drives of different sizes together, and it actually makes it uses all the space in most cases, and that's
right, as much as it can, right?
As much as it can, and the way it does it is instead of using 4 terabyte chunks, it might use 1 terabyte chunks across all the drives. And so if you've got one drive that can hold 6 1-terabyte chunks, well, fine, that's great. We'll just put them that way. And so it gets smart about it. That's how this works. Yep. SHR is Synology's version of that.
That sort of Beyond RAID thing or Smart RAID thing.
It's their Beyond RAID thing. There is a notable caveat with Synology's SHR. That is, when you start, you can put in drives of literally any size, and it will build the best that it can out of whatever Frankenstein you wind up putting in there. So if you have a 320 terabyte and a 2 terabyte drive and a 4 terabyte drive and another 4 terabyte drive, just throw them all in there. It'll do its darndest, and it'll tell you if there's any additional storage that it's unable to use because of one thing or another.
Right.
The issue is, if you did that and then you decided to replace one of those drives, let's say you go to replace your 320 gigabyte drive, you have to, with SHR, this is not true of Drobo, with SHR, you have to replace with a drive that is equal to or larger than the largest drive you currently have. So you'd have to put a 4 terabyte or larger drive in that particular setup I just described. Yeah.
Probably not too bad in most cases, though.
No, it's not. I've run into it.
Because drives just keep getting cheaper and bigger, so chances are
do.
When you're turning when around you're, to replace it, right?
Yeah, but when your 320 dies and you want to replace it immediately and you have a 1 terabyte on the shelf that, you know, came out of something else, you can't use it.
You can't use that,
Right. So that's the only issue there. But I would definitely, definitely use SHR in every Synology unit you have, unless you know specifically that your use case means you want to use, you know, some traditional RAID. But otherwise, right. SHR is the way to go, because you can start with just 2 drives and it'll mirror them. And then when you add a 3rd drive, now you're in, you know, striping with parity mode. You can add drives of different sizes and immediately use their additional storage. It's the right way to do it. There's very rarely is there good reason to not use SHR.
Awesome. Okay, last thing. He mentions, since he's starting with the 2 2-terabytes, if he goes SHR, he's saying, can I change from SHR to SHR2? Is there 2 different variants of SHR?
I believe what he's talking about is SHR is whether or not, whether he has 1 drive worth of fault tolerance, meaning any 1 drive can fail and the system can recover from that, or 2 drive fault tolerance, which means 2 drives can fail.
Okay. So this makes sense. I think what he wants to do is, because he's only going to have 2 drives to start.
Yeah.
1 drive fault tolerance, obviously. But now when he adds a 3rd or a 4th, he's probably going to want, if he wants the 2 drive fault tolerance, can he just switch over?
I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I think that's a decision you need to make
up front.
But, you know, for most of us, 1 drive fault tolerance is all you need. It doesn't mean that a 2nd drive can never fail. It means that a 2nd drive can't fail until you've either replaced the 1st drive that just failed,
right,
and finished that process. And that can be a days long process as it all the data is rebuilt. Or if you weren't, let's say you had 4 2-terabyte drives in there. So you have effectively 6 terabytes of usable space with the 1 drive worth of parity. And you're only using, let's say, 2 terabytes of storage on there, and one of your drives dies. You can tell the disk station to rebuild itself so that it's only using 3 drives in its SHR. And now you've got 4 terabytes of usable storage, but you've only got 2 terabytes of data, so you're totally fine. And once it finishes that rebuild process, then you're good to go.
Yeah.
Now you're back at you know, normal, healthy volume status and could lose another drive.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing about this is, and I haven't talked about this too much, but my general philosophy is that fault tolerance is not to be used as a backup.
No.
And I think some people confuse that. Right. It's like, well, if I have this thing and it's got fault tolerance on the drives, then I don't need a backup of that data because I have a backup, right? That
the way I point to that is I say, that's true. However, what happens when you delete a file you didn't intend to?
Right.
When does fault tolerance help you there? And the answer is it doesn't. It only helps you against a fault in the hardware, not a fault in the, you know, the error between the chair and the keyboard.
Right. Well, even in the hardware, I don't know. I just personally never trusted it. So, you know, my iTunes library is two places. I have a second backup. I don't, you know, have it on my external and I have a second backup. Or if I had it on a RAID, I would still have a second backup someplace else, at least one. And actually, I always have two personally because I'm crazy about stuff like that.
That's the cool part about a NAS is you can do cool things. You know, Synology has their own backup software. So if you had a second Synology, either locally or remotely, you could back up to that. CrashPlan will run on these things and you can either back up your Synology to CrashPlan's own servers or... You know, if you and a friend both have Synologies and you have room for each other's backups on your units, you could actually crash plan to each other. You know, there's all kinds of
cool stuff.
Options.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fault tolerance for all its coolness is, you know, I just advise people don't use it. Don't assume that that's a backup, you know, like it's not.
Right.
You still have just one drive and you need another backup somewhere.
So yeah.
That's kind of how you think about it. All right. Cool. Dave, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and attention. Obviously, this is something you and John do on your show. You want to tell, you know, week after week and have done for years. You want to tell people about the show and where they can find it and get it and all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. The podcast I do with John Braun is called Mac Geek Gab at MacGeekGab.com. And we do Q&A every week. It's mostly what we do. A lot of people have described us as, you know, car talk for Apple geeks. You know, we share different opinions and stuff too. But certainly happy to answer folks' questions and NAS units and all of this is a common topic. It doesn't dominate every show, but it's certainly a recurring theme. And we're happy to bring it back up when you folks need it. So we'd love to have you as listeners.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff, as you can tell.
So there you go. Dave Hamilton from the Mac Geek Gab. If you're not already subscribed to that, you really should check it out. It is a really great show. I'm learning stuff from Dave and John all the time, especially on kind of deeper topics like this networking and a lot of this nitty gritty stuff. And I love it. I love it. All right. iOS folders without a name. Andrew emailed me. He was showing off this really cool way to organize your apps. And this is something I've seen before. I've thought about doing myself. And it comes about because many of us have so many apps. And if you're like me, you typically don't browse through your apps when you want to launch one. You fire up Spotlight, you do a little search, and you launch the app from Spotlight. So if you're doing that, and I organize all my stuff into folders and categories and things like that, those aren't really necessary if all you're doing is launching from Spotlight. So why not do something a little bit more fun, a little bit more creative with your apps and organize them in a little different way? And so what Andrew had done is he sent me the screenshot. He organized all of his folders into folders by color. So what you end up having is sort of this sort of rainbow palette of folders. So you can go from, you know, red to orange to yellow to blue, to green, to violet, you know, all those sorts of things. And I'm not doing my colors in the right order. Roy G. Biv, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. So moving into the purples, right? So get them all organized like that. And it looks great on your springboard, on your home screen. But one thing that kind of breaks it up is the folder names, because by default in iOS, you cannot have a folder without a name. It has to have a little label. And so some people have kind of worked around that by just entering like a period, but then you still have a little tiny dot that's visible as your folder name. Luckily, though, Andrew found this cool little bug that solves the problem of having a folder, setting up a folder without a name. And oddly enough, it comes about via the Starbucks app. So in order to get this to work, you do have to have the Starbucks app on your device. As you'll hear here in a second, though, you don't have to keep it. So this is the good news. If you're not a fan of Starbucks, some people don't like or want the Starbucks app, you can just use the Starbucks app to get this little trick to work. So what Andrew discovered is that if you take the Starbucks app, and I'm going to assume you know how to create folders on an iOS device, but just in case you don't, you tap and hold on the icon, on an app icon, until it wiggles, right? You get into the little wiggle mode, and then you take the icon and you drag it on top of another icon. And then when you do that, it'll pop up the folder interface, usually ask you to give it a name, and that creates the folder. It'll even pre-populate that name based on the two apps that you're combining. So if they're both games, for example, it's going to assume that the folder you're creating wants to have the title of games. But with this bug, what happens is if you take the Starbucks app and you drop it on top of the other app or icon, it pops up in a folder, but that folder has no name. So then you can just save that, and now you have a folder without a name, and then you can just move the Starbucks app again and keep creating folders. Just make sure that you use the Starbucks app as the app that you drop on the other app to start that folder creation process, and you're good to go. So set up all your folders without your names, and then if you don't want the Starbucks app anymore, you can remove it, and the folders are going to remain nameless. And I thought that was a really cool little trick, especially if you want to have this kind of visual way of managing your home screen and your Springboard and stuff like that. So thank you, Andrew, for sending along that tip, and I was very happy to be able to pass that along. All right, with that, that is going to kind of do it for this episode of the MacCast. I do have one more thing for you, and this is really awesome because our friend Dave Sparks, who does Mac Power Users, and also you've probably heard him on the show with his Mac Sparky Field Guides. These are great iBooks that Dave has put together that teach you how to do really cool stuff. One of my favorite ones is email. If you want to really deep dive and get into email and cool tips and tricks regarding email, he has a Mac Sparky Field Guide for that. But he just released his latest Mac Sparky Field Guide, which is presentations. And he has generously given us 5 free copies of presentations. So I have App Store codes or iBook Store codes from David, and I want to give those away because this is an awesome ebook or iBook covering everything you need to know about creating and giving great keynotes and presentations. So it's not just how to build keynote presentations and do those. He gets into all of the aspects, how to become a better speaker, how to actually, you know, give the actual presentation. So it's got all this great video, all this great content, and I want to get some copies to you so you can check it out. So what we're going to do is the first 5 people to send me an email with the subject line, present me presentations, please. Present me presentations, please, in the subject line. Send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I will send you back a code to get a free copy of David's book. And I'm going to be a stickler about these directions. So the subject line needs to be exact. I don't care what you put in the body of the email. You don't even have to put anything in the body if you don't want. But the subject needs to be present me presentations, please. And then I will send you back a code. And if you don't get a code back within a few days, you can just assume you didn't win. I'm not going to reply to all these, you know, saying you didn't win. So I'll just send codes to the first 5 people, and that will be it. But if you don't get a code, really consider buying the book because it's amazing, and it's only $10 on the iBook store. So I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com so you can find it easily. But if you just search for Mac Sparky on the iBook store, all of David's Mac Sparky Field Guides are going to pop right up. And a huge thanks to David for doing that. I thought that was really, really great. And I'm happy to be able to share that book with you because it truly is awesome. But with that, that is going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for iOS, as well as PDF Pen for iOS. And be sure to check out their latest app, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get More information and details on all of their great apps over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, and explore new hobbies with easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial simply by going to lynda.com/mattcast. And a big thank you to all of my show sponsors for their support of the show. I'd also like to mention that bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly at cachefly.com, and advertising on the show is handled by Backbeat Media at backbeatmedia.com. I'd like to say a big thank you to you for your support of the show, for staying subscribed, for listening, also for all the great feedback and comments and questions that you send me every week. If you'd like to send a question or you have a comment, you can send email attachments, audio files, as well as just your text questions to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Or if you prefer, you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we do have a Google Plus community as well. If you're on that, just search for MacCast on Google Plus and it will pop right up. But that's where you'll find us hanging out online. There's some places you can check out between shows. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.